Greetings, Reyes community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Mark Delos Reyes Davis, who serves as Vice Chancellor for University Relations at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and President of the UC Santa Cruz Foundation. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Brent. Glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's thank Scott Morey, because I was catching up with Scott, who is a great leader in the space, and we're talking about the podcast. He's been a guest, and I said, hey, who'd be great to host? And he immediately shared your name. And so I'm sure as we talk through your journey, we'll connect with your intersection point with Scott. But to kick off, I'd love to ask you what I have been asking most of our guests, which is, tell me a little bit more about your higher education journey. Take me back to junior year of high school. Who is that, Mark? What was he into, and what led him to Northern Arizona University?
Oh, interesting. I thought you were going to say, you said high school versus college. So I wasn't thinking about high school. I think in high school, I was, like any other high school student, kind of focused on going to college, thinking.
Where were you?
I was in Arizona. In a small town on the kind of the border of Nevada and Arizona. I just had my reunion just recently. Got to see a lot of folks.
Give the high school a shout out. What's the high school?
It was Mojave High School. Yeah. And a place called Bullhead City, Arizona. And we had our 30-year reunion just recently. So it was kind of a fun opportunity to interact with each other. Yeah, so I had some great friends. I was in student government, involved in a lot of the things that a lot of folks are involved in. And my sister and I were both first generation college grads. And so she went on to Northern Arizona. When I was thinking about school, certainly I idolized, or my sister was always my mentor. And so I always kind of followed her lead. One of the reasons why we went to Flagstaff, besides kind of the personal connections to the space, is that we grew up in a small town in New Mexico that was up in the mountains, and Flagstaff was as close to that experience as anything, at least in Arizona. And so we just had a kind of a fondness for both, obviously, the academics, but it was really a place that we felt comfortable, and a community that we felt comfortable in being part of. And then I went to college, had a wonderful time.
How much older was your sister?
She's 2.5 years.
And so there was going to be an opportunity for you all to be there together.
Absolutely. Yeah. She was an RA, and, when you're a freshman and she has like an apartment style residence hall, I'd crash there and watch movies and things like that, because she had a much better setup than I did. She was great, and we're very close friends.
Did you know going there what you wanted to study? I think, as a fellow first gen college grad, oftentimes there's not as much of the maybe pre-planning earlier in life that sometimes can be more common when parents have gone to college. But how much focus did you have when you arrived at NAU?
That's a great question. I think for folks who are first gen, you have both the support of your family going into it, and also the responsibility. And oftentimes when you're not familiar with a lot of different academic disciplines, you focus on business, because in your mind, business, you can make money, and making money is how you sustain yourself and how you support your family and how you support your career. So in many ways, like many others, I went into business administration. I don't think I had a passion for it, in the sense of like that was my burning desire to be in that, but is what seemed logical to me and more practical. And along the way in college, I developed appreciation for a wide range of things like you're supposed to do, right? You're supposed to open your eyes to new experiences, new diverse viewpoints. My family is Filipino American, and we certainly had our share of experiences growing up, and both in the sense of the diversity of our family background, and also being in a small town and being in a diverse family in a small town, all those things are kind of interesting. So then when you kind of go to a university, which again, is what we boast about the university experience. You're thrusted in the middle of all these different people. You learn so much about yourself, about other people, and about your passions. And I did find my passion while I was in college, and it wasn't in business, although I continued with that degree. And I think that degree certainly helped me in the sense of foundationally understand and apply it through my career, but it's certainly within a different area.
What passion did you uncover?
So my junior year at the university, I became the student regent for the Arizona Board of Regents. And so in Arizona, the three universities are under one board appointed by the governor. And there's one, at that time, there was one voting student. And I served on that board for 1 year as a junior, highly naive, but certainly passionate and invested. And from that experience, you learn what governance means, like what the both on the you're experiencing the education that you're receiving while at the same time you're making policy decisions that will govern the institution long term. And that was just obviously eye-opening. There are several members of that board who are just wonderful mentors. And one was Eddie Basha, who was a former gubernatorial candidate in Arizona and an amazing, amazing person who just kind of takes you under their wings and kind of help guide you, but also allow you to have your own voice. You know, you find your own voice in that experience. And that year was pretty interesting because there were a lot of kind of hot topics that were going on that forced you to kind of develop opinions about things that you never thought you had opinions about or never called to have opinions about, but you needed to make good policy decisions for the institution and for your fellow students. And so that certainly guided me to stay in higher education thereafter.
It's amazing. Like I think about, especially, you know, with the first gen background, when you essentially, you know, arrive at college with very little network as it relates to ultimate career outcomes and limited maybe subset of mentors that are going to really guide you. I mean, I had coaches, for example, that were awesome, positive influences in my life, but they weren't going to guide me professionally. And then in an instant, you're sitting next to Eddie Basha, or in my case, I had that equivalent person that goes from this kind of nebulous, you know, successful business person to like an actual person that you're sitting next to. And then you realize, or at least in my experience, and I'm guessing yours too, you realize, hey, I can sit with this person. I can converse with this person. I can contribute. I can engage. And sometimes like just getting a window into sort of how normal those wildly successful beyond your previous dreams people are, can be a really powerful experience. I don't know if that resonates at all.
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting because I mean, it's also the experience you have in the development world too, because there's both, a realization that everyone, you know, we're all people trying to do the best we can in the spaces that we're in. Some people have more resources than others, certainly. And sometimes because of that, they could have more of an impact or a greater responsibility of having an impact. You also have the experience of being like, you know, imposter syndrome, of being in this room and feeling like you don't have as much to contribute as they do, both because of your age, your experiences, and potentially your status as you viewed it in society. And that's all, you know, that doesn't go away. Like that's a constant reflection that all of us have, especially those of us who have kind of been the benefactors of this kind of social mobility that occurs powerfully through higher education. And so I know my kids will have a very different experience than I had. And that's all because of the experiences I have. Certainly, some of it is amazing because that's what you want. You want your kids to have a better life than you had. And some of it, you also want them to understand the struggles and the challenges you've had too, because it was a lot of hard work, a lot of hardship that got you where you are.
See, and I that resonates. I've got three boys and there's this constant balance of, you know, how do I help make it easier for them and also not make it too easy for them?
That's right. That's right.
So you're doing the student regent program. You're getting to sit at tables that you might not have imagined back at Mojave High. And my sense is that also led to this alumni student ambassador experience. Or just tell me a little bit about your gateway drug to the advancement leadership role you're in now.
Yeah, I think, you know, I kind of did everything in college. I was an RA. I became an RA at some point. I was part of other organizations. I ran for student government. So I think it was the combination of being the student regent and seeing how institutions operate. And then also I was in I think what we called them Lumberjack alumni ambassadors. And you were, you know, a person that the organization called upon when alumni were in town and needed either a tour of the campus or to learn more about what the current experience was. And so, you know, you learn a little bit more about the alumni association, the alumni office, what they're intending to do. And I think that was just, you know, one of many experiences, but certainly was kind of eye-opening to future pathways. I don't think I ever thought at the time that I was going to go into alumni relations. Like I didn't have that kind of epiphany. It was more of just finding paths after college and that you can actually work in higher education and support the very kind of foundational organization that kind of made such a difference in your life, and find a career in that space. Wouldn't I think as a first gen, you never, unless you have really great mentors and a lot of exposure in many different ways, you never thought of a career through higher education until you got there, you know, in some ways.
And so did you immediately begin in the higher ed world after college, or what was your first step?
Yeah, no, I got a, again, you know, it's interesting, you know, in life, everybody says that I always am kind of suspect of people said that I made it on my own. Because we don't, none of us do. There are so many shoulders that we kind of are on top of because they've helped get us where we were. And so during my student regent years and being involved, there was a local chamber of commerce that provided an opportunity for me right after college to be their government affairs manager. It was very low paid but it was
safe space.
Absolutely. He would laugh at it. He's still in that chamber of commerce space still. And it was great. You know, it is a position that I was able to build myself working with him and find a pathway, because I got exposed to government relations while I was both in student government as well as student regent. And so it was a great path. I was only in that for about, I think, 6 to 8 months. And then the opening to come back to the university to run its centennial opened up, and it was kind of seemed like it was a job written for me at the time.
How did that get on your radar? Did somebody reach out to you? Did you see it? Were you sort of just hanging around campus? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, that was more than 20 years ago. I don't entirely recall. I feel like a friend of mine sent it to me and felt like it was exactly up my alley. But I applied, went through the interview process, and then I just stayed in higher education ever since.
So leading the centennial, what was the highlight of that experience? What was the actual job? You know, sort of one of those nebulous, like every institution has their
right
of that celebration, but what exactly is that role?
Well, it's primarily like a marketing director, right? So you're using this marketing construct of an institutional anniversary, a milestone in its history, to both create more exposure for the institution and engage more stakeholders in what's happening at that institution today. So hopefully they'll invest either philanthropically or through their support. And so that's what I did for a number of years, because it was a pretty well-planned anniversary where it was multiple years until the lead year. And then when that concluded, I didn't actually know what I was going to do next. The position of alumni director opened up at the university, and I certainly work with those colleagues very closely during the centennial. I think I was only in my early 20s. And so I applied and eventually got appointed to the role quite early in my life. And it was, you know, a wonderful experience. And
I mean, do you ever meet somebody today who's like 24 and you think to yourself, I was the leading the alumni?
Yeah. Yeah. Have. Looking back, it's kind of like a lot of people took some risks on me, I think. And that's why I certainly value those individuals who did that. But I think, you know, it's a little bit of both, right? It's those who support you and believe in you, and you have to prove yourself in that time frame. And then it's a lot of hard work, you know. Those hours that we worked back then were just extraordinary. But it was a passion project, so you definitely were committed to it. But I loved it. Yeah, it provided me opportunities, you know, fully to jump in and start managing people, programs. I was used to managing budgets by then, but the intricacies of high HR and how do you lead a team? How do you inspire them? How do you make effective decisions were things that I had to really learn about very quickly. I didn't always make great decisions, but I think you always learn about those experiences and apply them to future challenges.
Very, very common that many of the leaders that we've spoken with on this podcast have begun their careers with their alma mater. You know, they were a student caller and they got looped in. They were the student leader, they got looped in. That was sort of your experience. You spend 5 years getting some really neat leadership experiences early in your career. It is a very different thing to decide, this is now my career path. I'm going to be an advancement professional, and I'm going to move out of, you know, maybe fly out of the nest of the alma mater and do this for an institution that I don't have necessarily deep ties or connections to. And so tell me about coming to that sort of conclusion, and then what led you to join Rice University?
You're right. When you become an alumni director more than once, it becomes a little bit more of a career than you probably entered the role. I didn't enter the role to think that that's what I was going to do the rest of my life. So I think if I remember right, there was a search firm that was recruiting for that position. And again, as a first gen, I wasn't really familiar with the higher education ecosystem, the different types of, and I certainly understood the difference between private and public, but I didn't really think about rankings when I made my decisions for going to school. I was really more about feeling comfortable in the space and where I can succeed. And the Rice position opened up, and I was probably very naive when I approached the role, because I don't think I understood the caliber of institution that it was going in. I think it had certainly understood the reputation, but I was still young in my life and my career. In some ways that helped me, I think, in the interview process, because I had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder and wasn't, I think, intimidated by the experience. I didn't get intimidated till I arrived there and had my interactions from my colleagues and the campus itself. And quite honestly,
there was more about that, because there's this interview experience and then there's showing up for the first week, second week. And I want to know more about maybe that tension that you experienced.
You know, I think, you know, Rice is a very serious place. It has extraordinarily smart people. When you are accepted to the institution, either as a student or as a staff or faculty, there's both this kind of expectation of excellence that you receive, or a responsibility of excellence that you are given, and also kind of a trust and respect at the same time. And so when you're surrounded by folks in that kind of space, you know, Nobel laureates who are still working there at the time, just extraordinarily talented faculty and students, and the team I had there were just extraordinary. I learned so much from them. And I appreciated their patience and their kind of just ability to take a risk with me. I think the selection committee, you know, hopefully saw something that I thought I had, and they saw it a little bit. But, you know, there's a little bit of luck and a little bit of right place at the right time kind of stuff that occurred. And I just found a lot of people that saw something in me and took a chance. There are two wonderful things that happened when I first got there that still happen to this day. One, my boss there, who I still stay in contact with frequently, Eric Johnson, he's the one that hired me. He was the vice president of development or resource development at the time. He was the first thing he did when I showed up on my first day, he shook my hand and said, thank you for choosing us. And it's a statement that is simple, but something I have used ever since, because it's an acknowledgement that the person who they've hired made a decision. It wasn't just a congratulations, you got the position. It was a, we know you have choices and you chose to come here. And that was a, you know, certainly a very symbolic and very meaningful gesture. The other thing is the president of the Alumni Association at the time, the volunteer president, Vicki Bretthauer, she was amazing. On the 9th of every month, she would call me just to check in and see how things were going, just as a mentor, just making sure everything was going. And her intention was just to do that for a few months. And I think I started my work there back in 2002, I believe. So 21 years later, on the 9th of every month, I get a text from her or vice versa, just checking in. So there's just the quality of people at Rice it was just foundational to me. And my whole goal when I got there was that I was the first non-alum to run that position. And so my goal was, you know, by the time I was at least a few years in, that everyone would have thought I was an alum of that institution, that I breathed the values of the institution and could carry my own weight in that space. And so, and I think I, with the help of so many people, were able to do that.
You spent almost 8 years there, a very good run. What was the single favorite memory that you have from your time at Rice?
Oh, that's hard. Yeah.
Experiences, donor experiences. I mean, anything stand out?
Well, I think there are so many. I'd say the one that kind of had a pivotal kind of change in my life. So it's not my a favorite, but it's one that probably led me to the next kind of thing. So I was there as head of alumni, and then halfway through that experience, I switched into being the senior advisor to the president of the university, kind of running his office with a colleague, a wonderful colleague, Cindy Wilson. For the president of the time, David Lebron. And what we did was, you know, obviously push forward his initiatives, and I was in charge of his international, pursuing, you know, coordinating his international agenda, and would travel with him and his wife Ping to China and to India and to other places. And when I gave up 1 year as in charge of both, I ran the office, and then I was running Alumni Association, and then I decided to kind of move all the way into the president's office. But I wanted something of substance that was my own. Certainly was attached to the president, but something that I can kind of own in the sense of kind of pushing forward an agenda that's and that's why the international part came forward, because it was an area of interest for me all my life, and I was able to do it. So that opportunity came only because when that position became open, my current boss, Eric, knew that I was kind of not peaking, but was ready for a new challenge. And that in many ways provided that conversation with the president and with me to kind of assume that new role. And again, it's just people who are looking out for you professionally and personally. And that kind of led me into, you know, moving to China and doing all these things afterwards in a different way. So, and I still keep in contact with David and others too, like all these people, it's interesting. It all tied back to people, because people are just, universities are only as good as the people that work there and who are part of it. And I've just been very fortunate, both in Arizona and at Rice at the time, to be surrounded by just great people.
When did Tsinghua University first get on your radar?
So when I was going to China, part of my role was accompanying the president to all these institutions of higher learning in China. And so we would travel, you know, whether it was for a week or 3 weeks at one time, and we would visit all these different universities that the institution was trying to either explore collaboration or reinforce the collaborations that existed. And it was during the boom time, you know, it was right after the Olympics in China. And so all these universities were doubling in size, building brand new campuses within years. It was just kind of a phenomenon to watch. And I knew I had to go back for my graduate degree. Up until then, I had not done it. And mostly because the areas that I was interested in were not available as part-time degrees. And also I'm one of those individuals, I have to kind of go all in or I won't do it well because my job will always win that. Yep. So I decided it's time to really pursue it. I was very interested in China. And so I decided to kind of just do it, jump in. And I moved to Beijing, got accepted obviously to Tsinghua, and then was an older grad student, I'd say. But it was an amazing experience living in Beijing during those years. And the people you meet, the experience you have, people always say that you don't know your country until you leave it. And I think that's very true. It opens your eyes on how everyone else views the United States. And my family, obviously, I have an international family already, but I never, since I was, until, you know, except for when I was very, very young, always lived in the United States. So that was a transformative experience. I met my husband there, who is not Chinese, he's actually from Spain. But all that was just fundamental to what I did afterwards and how I kind of continued my career.
And so my brother volunteered at the 08 Olympics, and he took a 4-week kind of, you know, student volunteer program there, and did not come back feeling like that's a place I could live for a few years. Like, it was just so overwhelming. But, you know, an amazing, I think, experience for him, but it's very different to sort of visit and have a good experience versus decide, especially when you are at an institution, you know, you're at Rice, you had experience at NAU, you're meeting people at all the universities around the country, to decide to go and pursue that internationally. Was there like a vision of where you thought that might take you, or did it just feel like an exciting right step at that moment? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Was it part of a bigger plan, I guess? Yeah.
I think there are multiple things that were going on. One, I think, you know, another, again, colleague of mine, when I assumed the role in the president's office, they had, you know, really good advice for people in the chief of staff roles. I took it and I kind of didn't take it at the same time. But they say, you know, you can't do those roles forever. You need to, you know, do it for a number of years and then you need to move on. And the reason why is because you become so much a part of another person's agenda. You know, you try to be a thought partner. You try to convey what they would want to convey. You try to write as like they write. You know, all those things, you're trying to emulate what you think they would do so that they can have the best product they can have, and then to make the decisions they need to make. And so you don't lose your own professional identity in that space, but you could. And that's why they kind of made that recommendation. And so I knew I was not coming to that point. I have so much wonderful feelings about David and Ping and value them so much. But I think I kind of blame them for the exposure to China, because that's what sparked my interest in going, because of what they introduced me to. So I think one was this realization that if I wanted to pursue, you know, if I wanted to be a vice president, at an institution and continue my career in certain ways, that a graduate degree was necessary. I also kind of felt I was getting older, and it is now or never. And then I had this, you know, passion for international relations, and specifically at that time, what was going on in China. So it's kind of all kind of, some of it was just strategic, and then some of it was just the timing.
How much did you end up having to, or end up studying the language?
So the program was an international program. If your Chinese was strong enough, you could take the Chinese based courses. If your Chinese, like mine, was poor, you took Chinese classes, language classes, plus your international relations classes. So it didn't prevent you from going there and getting your degree. It limited in some ways your exposure, because, you know, being in a all Chinese class would have been very different than in their, you know, in that language, in those subtleties would have been a very different experience. And some of my colleagues were that great at both languages and were able to do courses on both. The value I got was certainly from the international students and Chinese students whose English skills were so strong that they could be in the classes that we were in and develop those relationships, friendships, and discuss, you know, challenging topics in that international space. And so so for me, it worked out generally okay.
Any just favorite memories in Beijing, or recommendations for those listening who are maybe planning a trip? Just any highlights that you might not see in the standard blog.
Interesting. Yeah. When we live there, there's always this kind of statement about, you know, 1 year in Beijing is 7 years somewhere else. It was advancing or changing so drastically in such a very short amount of time. So what I remember and the places I went are probably very different now. I haven't been back for about 4 years. But, you know, you always have your favorite restaurants, favorite areas of the city. The nightlife was, you know, pretty amazing. It is a very international city. For me, is, you know, I think fond memories is riding my bike in the subways, because I had to take two subway lines and have two bicycles stationed in two different places for me to get to where I needed to get to go home and to get to campus. And so I think just being part of immersed in the city is great.
You know, you're in an urban commuter vibe when you've got two bikes.
Very cheap bikes that didn't work very well, but yes, I did do it.
After the degree, and you made a move not quite all the way back to the mainland, but stopped in Hawaii for a few years, which I'm sure to everybody sounds amazing. And you know, like any place, I'm sure has great experiences and trade-offs. But tell me about the highlight, and what stands out is you've kind of gravitated toward these chief of staff / you know, international officer roles, which is not that common among the folks that that I've hosted up until now.
Yeah, so when we left Beijing, I got married and in Spain, and we thought we were going to land in New York. We actually stayed in New York for about 4 months, getting I was interviewing for several roles at the time, and we were making some kind of hard decisions about where we wanted to be. And you know, anytime you're applying for roles, there's always risk in the ones you accept and the ones you turn down. And so we were there, and we thought we were going to be there and having a really good experience. And pardon me. And a call came from Hawaii that said, what do you think about this position? And I remember we were in this apartment, you know, very small apartment in the Upper West Side. And I walked out of the room and I said, well, what do you think about Hawaii? Because it wasn't really on our radar. Certainly Hawaii was, but not in the sense of working or living there. And I remember we had an iPad, and I was like, because my husband is from Spain, like he's less familiar with very familiar with the geography, but, you know, not for every state. And so I was like, showing them the map, and it was like mainland US and then ocean as you mapped, and then Hawaii. And so we said, well, let's try it. Like, you know, we were open, we were adventurous at the time, no kids, all those things. And so we said, okay. And I flew out and had just a really great interaction with the president of the university. And he was a former president of Butler. His name is Jeff Bannister. He's now retired. And he took over this private university in Hawaii that he saw some wonderful opportunity and potential with. And we moved there. We decided to do it. Totally different experience, totally different institution than we have ever been part of. And loved it. Loved every part of it.
I didn't have a lot of familiarity with it. My understanding is it's right in downtown Honolulu, and I was surprised to see the top employers of Hawaii Pacific University are in order: the U.S. Army, the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, the U.S. Marine Corps, and the United States Department of Defense. So that's a pretty unique top employer list. And yeah. I'd love to know more just about the, you know, that dynamic and the overall reflections from that experience.
Yeah, no, it's a place that kind of grew up very quickly as an institution, and it had a very large presence on the different military bases in Hawaii, providing those in the military who were stationed there at the time to continue their education, whether it's at the undergraduate or graduate level, mostly the, you know, obviously the graduate level, but also the undergraduate. And so that's probably why the top number of graduates. It also had a, you know, a strong education and nursing program, and others that were more kind of locally based. But they also have like other institution people on the mainland and other places. There's a large contingency of Scandinavian students who go to Hawaii as well. And so if you looked at the largest international population of Hawaii Pacific, it was mostly Norwegian, Sweden, a lot of other places in Europe, for various reasons. I think certainly the weather probably drew a lot of them, but there was also really great kind of collaborations and easy access to transfers of credits that made it work. But I loved that experience because it was an institution that was trying to make the most of opportunity. It was a visionary president who took big risks and made big changes. It was during a time when a lot of universities were going under, and this institution was trying to reinvent itself, staying core to its values and being, you know, highly focused on serving the residents of Hawaii in a very difficult market.
So I know that you connected with Scott during your time at Rice University, and I had an opportunity to reconnect as colleagues at Carnegie Mellon. So tell me about that experience and serving as campaign director and getting to work with Scott.
So Scott's amazing. So when in Hawaii, well, one of the things about Hawaii that's interesting is that, I fell in love with the culture, with the people. It is a wonderfully rich, vibrant, diverse state. And it is, as a Filipino American, is one of the first places I ever lived where I was not the minority. I would be considered Hapa, and that was a dominant population of residents of Hawaii, and just felt embraced both by the culture, the local culture, the individuals. And that has stayed true to me, and just the culture of how we interact with each other, the talk story before meetings, all those things that connect you to the people, the land, and the environment are very present in how I think I live today. But the president of the university was about to retire. He announced it. And so I knew my position would be kind of somewhat susceptible to changeover. We were flying back and forth to Europe because that's where my husband's family is. And, you know, that's a very long flight. That's Hawaii. Get over the mainland US and then get to Europe. And at the time, Scott was looking, had just moved to Carnegie Mellon and was looking for a campaign director. And I was looking to get back into being more in a field or a discipline. I kind of moved into international relations and the chief of staff role. And I think I was ready to kind of move back into advancement. And we had just a number of wonderful conversations. I interviewed at campus, met with the president and others. And I just felt both supportive and inspired by what Scott was trying to achieve. And I kind of felt like I had the kind of experiences that would be helpful to him in pursuing those. And at the same time, I wanted to kind of shore up a lot of my advancement experiences in a different way. At the same time, you know, obviously deploying the expertise that I had as well. Scott and I were he was the head of alumni at GW when I was at Rice. And that's how we first became acquainted and became, you know, obviously respected colleagues throughout that time. There's a number of us, like Donna at George Washington, Scott, Chris Marshall, Andy Shadlin. There are a number of us that were there together at the same time. So it's great to see how all of us have kind of our pathways in our careers.
Great group. Thanks for sharing. And then you had the opportunity to join UC Santa Cruz. I think, you know, an amazing institution. I mean, kind of bringing it full circle. I know over 30% of the students are first gen, for example. So I'm sure that aspect of the mission has to be really, really rewarding to you. But what else drew you there other than it being an amazing place, you know, in the country? And then certainly, I guess, you know, I don't love kind of going down the pandemic memory lane too often, but you joined in July of 2020. And so it had to be a really, you know, challenging, unique, different onboarding experience, if you will. And I'm sure it's been great, you know, this year, for example, to be able to do, you know, a lot of the things that I'm sure, you know, you wish you could have done earlier in the tenure.
Yeah, no, it has been a very interesting transition. You know, it's interesting. That's why, you know, you always have a choice of, always is probably not, it's too strong, but if you had your preference, you always choose the people you work with and for. And if you have that privilege, you always choose people who you can, who respect you, who are cheering for you and who understand when you need to make family decisions or professional decisions in ways. And Scott's one of those individuals, because I was very open to him when this opportunity presented itself at UC Santa Cruz, and he mentored me through that process of the as I was applying. I try to be very open about those as much as possible, because I out of respect to him and the opportunities that he has provided me, but also just out of respect, I didn't want him to find out from someone else. And so I think that's what's great, is that every opportunity or experience I've had, I've been very forthright with all of my former bosses, and they've been all very respectful and supportive in that. And that's what I think what you seek when you want to work for someone. And so this opportunity presented this whole kind of portfolio that kind of, as you said, was full circle. It kind of all these different kind of experiences that I've had throughout my career, from overseas marketing, communications, executive comms, alumni relations. I was a campaign director at Carnegie Mellon, so overseeing the fundraising operations, and then government affairs and community relations and federal relations, which was my first job out of college. All those kind of came in this portfolio and at an institution that obviously is part of one of the world's best public university systems in the world, University of California, to an extraordinary campus that's kind of built and its origins is on environmental and social justice, and a member of the AAU that is both kind of an indication of its research, leading research kind of focus, while this, as you said, this commitment to access, where 30% of the students are first gen, 40% are Pell eligible students. And they're also, you know, minority serving institution with being HSI and Anna Pizzi school, all those things, you don't find that. There's like a handful of institutions that have that kind of portfolio that they could boast of that portfolio. And that kind of synergy creates both an energy at the institution about opportunity, not only for the research that's happening here, but also the students who are involved. And if we get it right, as we get this right here, like there's no, it is a profound way to diversify Silicon Valley. It's a profound way to diversify STEM fields when public universities of this size, of this diversity, has access to cutting edge research, training opportunities, mentorship opportunities, and educational opportunities, and are deployed into the workforce in leadership positions, as well as other positions. Like that transforms society. And that's just a compelling vision. The chancellor is a wonderful person, both pragmatic and visionary, and also willing to learn. Like she's a great partner. Like you, when you want to work for someone, you want someone that's openly asking to learn from you, while at the same time you're learning and being mentored by them. And I, that's what I found.
You have staffed presidents in multiple roles, and that must give you a little bit of an advantage because you must have a counterpart that is the you now of the role that you've done previously. And so I would imagine that gives you a certain sense of empathy around what they're dealing with, what they're navigating. What advice would you have to other advancement leaders that that haven't sort of, I mean, obviously fundraising and any president are pretty much tied at the hip, but it's different than being like the chief of staff to the president and liaising with fundraising. What advice or perspective, or how does that inform how you engage with that office today?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting these days. I think there are more and more people probably like me that are, you know, have different pathways to these positions. I find the experiences I've had invaluable because I do care about the content. Like it's not just about the dollars raised, it's about the impact, right? And so when you understand how institutions work, the politics of universities, the priorities of institutions, how priorities are identified and developed, you often can provide better advice to chancellors, to presidents, and others. You can also provide better guidance to your team on how to present information. You could draw lines. You know, I could say, you know, that's not our responsibility. That's the responsibility of this other unit. We'll certainly help as best we can, but it's not our decision to make. But I think it's interesting because you can see how these kind of philanthropic opportunities can really transform the institution. And you can see all the moving parts that have to come into line to make it work. And so I think that is just something that I have seen for so many years that I try to, you just can't help but to be part of your perspective at the institution. So no advice, it's just more of definitely, you know, depend and lean on and get the advice of that chief of staff or that senior advisor to the university president, because they're the ones that are, they're helping the chancellor, the president achieve what they need to achieve. And they can guide you on how to be the most helpful to that person and how you can actually, it's everything from the briefing materials to preparing them for visits. All those things can be so much better executed if you're aligned with that advisor.
You have a couple more minutes. I know we're kind of at time, so I want to be respectful of that. But sure. I would love to just get your perspective on having worked so closely with presidents and being that sort of liaison and helping coordinate some of those big international trips, a week here, 3 weeks there. Then COVID happened, all of that stopped, and we went through this digital transformation overnight. And now we can go do a week-long trip or a three-week trip. And so how do you, like, do you feel like it's just back to the way that it was, or have there have been fundamental ways in that you can, you know, for example, we wouldn't have thought to have the president jump on a quick Zoom call with somebody in the past. It might have been that we had to do this whole scheduling thing to get the stars aligned and the calendar for the trip and the trip. And now, like, we went through a period where we could only do that. Now we're in this sort of hybrid period where we could go in person. There are trade-offs and benefits in doing so, or it could be a quick Zoom, or it could be a quick video hello, right? I mean, there's like this whole spectrum of, you know, high touch, high personalization to medium touch, medium personalization, and then the logistics around it. Like, how do you deploy a president as a partner in fundraising today relative to in 2019, for example?
Yeah, I
and maybe we're not sure yet because the pendulum is swinging, you know?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because we have all experienced where, you know, we fly there, we have the appointments booked, and then all of a sudden either someone gets sick or they're not available. And then all of a sudden we're doing a Zoom call from the hotel in that city with that person. That's not like the only reason you're there. So it's not, it doesn't veto the whole initial intention of the trip. But you just have to be resilient in that space. I think that thing in our line of work that's relationship based, nothing replaces in-person interactions. Everything from the nuances to what you're observing on the camera when people are responding to you or not, what they're hearing. It's all very, in order to do in Zoom, it's all very intentional, and a lot of things are left, you know, at the screen. So you may not see it. I think this kind of technology where it's helping us, this modality is helping us, is in the kind of reinforcement of those in-person visits.
Yeah.
Or to, it could be an intro for sure. But I think it's, in my mind, it's more of a reinforcement, an opportunity that you can, you know, do a quick 1 hour call and follow up to those in-person visits. But it's easy to ignore emails. It's easy to ignore those things. And so I think it's just kind of what's the right balance for your stakeholders, what makes sense based on that. Like if you think about federal, state, and government relations, sometimes they're not meeting in DC when you're in DC. And so you'll meet with others and then you have to do a Zoom call later. So it's kind of, it allows you probably to do more than you ever have done. Like as you're experiencing, right, and I'm experiencing, I have more meetings in a day than I ever had before COVID. And they're hybrid and in person and Zoom. And so it's kind of like, we're doing much more, I think, at least administratively in some ways, because I think the intentionality, since you don't have those kind of, you know, water cooler moments anymore, using the old term, as much, there's intentionality that meetings have to happen. You have to book it or you're never going to have that discussion. You know, it's not going to be. So like my team, majority of my team are remote. Only a few, my direct reports are hybrid. And then, except for gift processing and a few other units, most of them are fully from working from home or somewhere else. And that requires us to be very intentional about meetings, interactions, communications, and all division meetings when we bring everybody back. It's just a lot more work. I think you can't take those things for granted because you don't have that many opportunities to communicate and engage. And that's just on the staffing side. The same with stakeholders. If you don't have kind of casual ways to engage them over and over again, you have to be intentional about those interactions and be more strategic. And it's a moving target. It's what we do every day, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit like your, ninth of every month intentional touch point.
Right.
You know, how do you kind of do that in more facets of your life? Because sort of hoping and taking things for granted.
And she's better at it than I am. Like she's the one that I often forget, and then she's the one that prompts it. So it's amazing. Those are good people. You know, one of the questions you asked, kind of in writing before, you're talking about mentors. I don't know if you saw my response, but it was, I have found mentors unintentionally, and I think they were unintentionally mentoring me. It was just their operation, how they did their work. And I find that here too, that the workforce is so different now that I'm afraid to give advice to people that are, say, younger than me or people who are kind of moving up in their careers, because my advice may be the long way. You know, you first have to do this and you have to do this and you have to do this, and then you get the position you want, you aspire for. But that's not society now, right? Even my pathway, I was head of alumni when I was in my 20s. So it's each path is different for each person and each generation. And see, the only thing I can do, like I kind of steer away from mentoring folks because I feel like I may give the wrong advice based on the current context, is just is really the amplifying role, is helping them achieve what they want to achieve, but not kind of giving them the baggage of my baggage on how to get there, because I don't think it, our paths are so different nowadays.
One last closing kind of question for you. You shared that you believe we're underinvesting in stewardship and pipeline development in the advancement space. Why do you feel that way?
I think it's the reality of hitting our metrics, right? I think, you know, in the end, we have to raise money, and we have to raise money in a certain amount of time annually. And so it is natural to invest the resources you need to achieve those goals on an annual basis. It's a luxury to think long-term and to develop stakeholder engagement and pipeline development in a way as robust as we want it to be. But it's a cycle somewhat. And so I think about the department that I leave behind when I leave this role. Are they going to be in a better place than when I arrived? Are they going to be better positioned? Are they going to have a greater pipeline that they can work with and stakeholders much more engaged? I think that's part of it. It's this resource scarcity issue that all of us have, and kind of holding the line in when during budget times, budget crunch times, of not divesting of those kind of fundamental core parts of the program. That might be because I was in alumni relations from the beginning, but it's also, it's a reality that I've experienced, you know, here, is that we need to invest more in those spaces. And if we invest more in those spaces years ago or decades ago, we would have been in a very different place than we are today. And I just wanted to say, in case we don't get to it, the other thing I wanted to mention is we are in a reckoning where there are so few people of color in the senior leadership roles at universities, and specifically in advancement. And this is not a new discussion. We've talked about it for decades. And if you go to different conferences or programs or sessions, you know, we've made some advance, but not a lot. And I think we have, as an industry, have to think about why that is the case and how we're actively changing that over time. And and some of those are very hard conversations, and they're not easy conversations, they're not easy answers. But our populations, our stakeholders are becoming more and more diverse. And if we continue to not reflect that diversity in our leadership, in our field, we're not going to be able to engage, understand, and service the stakeholders in the ways that we need to going forward. There's an irony in the work that we do, because in some sense we're part of this kind of redistribution of wealth from folks who have raised and earned significant amount of wealth and money over time through, you know, obviously because of the work of so many people in various roles who have contributed to that wealth. And we're in the position to say, let's partner in this effort to ensure there's opportunity where opportunity didn't exist in the past. And I think that takes both a reckoning and a self-reflection on the donor's side and on the institutional side and the people who are interacting with those donors. And when we're both kind of working together in that process, then I think we'll make some systemic changes.
I think that's well said and a good note to conclude. I have to say, I don't know how much familiarity you have with the CASE graduate trainee program, but I think that has been an excellent step forward based on my interactions with that community and to really create an on-ramp of a very diverse, passionate group of people who have been direct recent beneficiaries of philanthropy. But those seeds are being planted that will take, 20 or 30 years to grow. It's not going to solve the problem in at the pace with which I think you're highlighting the urgency.
Brent, thank you. Appreciate your time.
Mark, I really appreciate it as well. It's been great to get to know you a little bit better. I hope that the audience enjoyed hearing more about your journey. This might be the first time we've really gone to China on the podcast. So thank you for taking us there. And with that, I'll conclude today's episode with Mark Delos Reyes Davis, who serves as Vice Chancellor for University Relations at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and President of the UC Santa Cruz Foundation. Thanks, Mark, and take care, everybody.